1 Corinthians, Paul says, "For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, you are God's building. According to the grace of God which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ." In this podcast, we explore those who went the wrong way. We examine why it happened, how it happened, and who it happened to. But most importantly, we always ask the question, could it happen to us? Thanks for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Before we begin, let us be clear. The opinions we present are ours alone and do not represent the views or opinions of our respective churches or employers. Now, let's begin. Okay, we are back again. We didn't talk about who was going to start this episode, y'all, so that's why there's a little pause that Brian will probably edit out, but we are back again, and today we are talking still about the Branch Davidians in Waco, the massacre there, and we have talked about the history of that. We've talked about how their society works and their social things and such, and we're now to Brian's favorite part, which is the theology.
That's right. That's right. This is where I enjoy spending my time.
As y'all all know, Brian is an expert in the seven seals.
Okay.
This is what David Koresh preached on. Basically, his whole theology was Revelation and the seven seals. He preached other things, but it all came back to this. He believed he was a prophet of God. So, you know, this theology thing's a little hard because he didn't well document stuff. And I just want to add, I think I mentioned it before. He was writing down and then and typing up. He was starting to record and then he was typing up his theology, basically. That was his last condition of surrendering to the FBI and the ATF. And supposedly he was finishing that and he was going to surrender. That's what he had told them. But he never he never did finish, and so when they raided, we never got that. And whatever he did type up got burned up. So that wasn't well documented.
No, we do have the first chapter of his manuscript, and it's weird because if you get on the YouTubes, right, and you search for anything of Koresh, right, you'll find there's the last recorded words of David Koresh.
Oh, was that?
And it's an interview.
That was on the radio station while they were in the siege, right?
No.
Oh.
That's part of it, right? But the actual last recorded words are a conversation that he was having with the negotiator, and the negotiator was recording it, obviously.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, the condition for release was, or for him to come out, was to just finish chapter one, right? He didn't have to finish the whole thing. He just wanted to finish chapter one and get it into his lawyer's hands. And then he was going to come out. If you listen to it, you know, it cuts off at the end. And so there's a little bit of speculation as to whether or not he was really planning on coming out or if the negotiator was just stirring him up, trying to get stuff going so that they could come in and do what they did.
Massacre women and children.
So he didn't have to. The stipulation wasn't that he got to finish the whole thing, but just chapter one.
Oh, okay.
Right? He was going to then be able to finish the rest after they went through all the trial and everything that was supposed to be going on that unfortunately didn't get to happen.
Yeah, I don't know whether they would have been able to convict him of anything anyway.
Right.
Yeah, the negotiators weren't truthful. Was he truthful? Maybe, maybe not.
Probably not.
Yeah, no. Probably not. But in the end, they busted in the walls and killed all the women and children. So, let's talk about what they believe. What were we able to figure out about what they believe?
So this was hard, right? This was, I would say this was harder than anyone that we've done so far, right? Because there's not a lot of recorded words, texts, videos, radio sermons of David Koresh, right? You know, we talked the first week about how, you know, Tony Alamo had his own TV show and his own radio show and was just constantly out in front of people. So there's all these different things that he's recorded and published. Jim Jones was the same way. The CSA was the same way. Heaven's Gate was the same way. You're right. They all had this common thread of the things that we're teaching, we're pushing out to everybody. But Koresh didn't have that, right? So it makes it very, very difficult to get the full picture of what they were teaching, right? We know that they come from the Seventh-day Adventists line, right? So a lot of the things, you know, the ultra-conservative, super heavy focus on prophecy, the law is super duper important kind of teachings. We know that those were most likely there, right? Simply because of their own traditional history.
But we don't know how strictly they observed, they stuck to the history.
Exactly. Exactly. We don't know, you know, was he simply teaching these things kind of as an aside? Were they the core and this prophecy stuff that we're seeing so much of was more of the aside? You don't get the full picture, right? But what we do have, right, gives us the picture of a couple of things, right? A couple of things that I've kind of picked out as these are pretty big deals, right? Who would have thought? The first, right, and I'm not going in order on my list. I'm sorry, Matt, if you're looking at my notes. We're going to start with number two. In one of his sermons, right, because there's a couple that are out there online. In one of them, he doesn't come out. It's hard, right? Because a lot of the things that he taught, a lot of the theological points that he's trying to make, he doesn't necessarily come out and directly say, right? But he implies them, right? He kind of makes a little point here and a little point there, you know, and when you put them all together, it leads to a specific teaching. And one of them is a soteriology, so a theology of salvation, that isn't the same as a lot of Protestant teachings, right? Definitely different than evangelical, right? He, at one point, taught that those who don't know the truth are going to be forgiven anyway. Which, I don't know about you, Matt, but I grew up in a Baptist church. And the Baptist church that was very focused on missions, their big thing was, if we don't go tell these people that don't know about Jesus, they're going to hell.
Was this a missionary Baptist church?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. No, I get that. You know, the whole thing at the end of Matthew, go ye therefore into all the world, right? Mm-hmm. That's a super, super big thing. So you're saying he didn't believe right. that. Is that a traditional Seventh-day Adventist view?
I couldn't find if that's necessarily an Adventist view. Because a lot of the Adventist teachings are, we're the only ones that are going to heaven. Right, they're very exclusive.
Well, and that's the impression I got from Koresh. Now, most of what I read was, like you were talking about, what other people said he said was mm-hmm. that they were a exclusive group, that they were the ones who were going to survive right. Through the apocalypse.
They were the ones who were going to survive and be the 144,000.
Right.
But in his implications, you know, if you don't know the truth, right, you're not going to be judged for not knowing the truth, right? Rather, he taught, which is honestly a more historical teaching, is that, you know, those who reject and refuse Jesus are his enemies. Those who don't know him you know, I've never heard about him. That's up to the mercy of Christ at the judgment. So, like I said, I mean, it's kind of a, it's hard because he implied it in a few small statements in one of his sermons. It could have been a, I didn't say that right kind of moment. You know, we've all sat in with a preacher that says something and you go up to him afterwards and he's like, I didn't say that right. That's not what I meant.
Oh yeah. We had a big controversy years ago. Jesus is not your homeboy.
Correct. He's the king of the universe.
I understand. But context matters. And the way you approach things matters. Mm-hmm. And when you start your sermon right. with, Jesus is not your homeboy, I reject this homeboy theology, you probably don't have an effective sermon when you came out of your own anger, your own self-righteousness, right. As if Jesus were somebody you had to, you know, protect on the schoolyard from the bullies.
Yeah, God doesn't need a big brother.
Yeah. So, years ago, we had that controversy in a church I was involved in, and we had a preacher who was very upset about this. Jesus is not your homeboy business. And when he was corrected on that by multiple people in positions that he was not, he was quite upset, and it took a long time to get past that. So, we've all... And I think he was a God-fearing man who was doing his best to serve the Lord, who honestly wanted to get up there and preach the right thing, but let his ego step in.
But just
yeah. We've all done that, you know.
Yep. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
So there's a chance that maybe he misspoke, said something a little weird. So I'm not going to come out and say that they taught, you know, some sort of universalism or anything like that. I don't think that's the case given the SDA history. But this could be a moment where he did differ from the SDA. I think it might have even been in the same sermon, right? Where he dug into how vitally important the law is, right? So again, SDA tradition, history, the law, right, the Ten Commandments, the Levitical law is still in effect and still very much must be obeyed.
Right, so they didn't celebrate...
Which is why they meet on Saturday.
They didn't celebrate a lot of holidays and things.
Right.
For that same reason, but they did celebrate some of the feast and stuff, right?
Right, yeah, they stuck with, you know... Passover,
Feast of Tabernacles, all those things.
Feast of Tabernacles and all of that. Yep. Yep. But one thing that he said, right? And again, right, it's you're pulling stuff out of one or two sermons that are available out there. He talked about the sacrifice of lambs for sin and that the Jews didn't really know what that meant. They just did it because God told them to, right? They didn't really understand. It wasn't one of those things, right? They just did it, right? Because you sacrifice a lamb for forgiveness of sins.
That's how I practice my religion. I just do it. I don't try to understand.
Well, see, here's the problem, right? When you're teaching, right, you're teaching this idea that you know the answers, right? That you understand, right? Because when we get to his teachings on the seals, that's his whole thing. He's like, I'm opening this to you. I understand what the entire history of salvation is.
Yeah, he taught that the Lord spoke to him. He was a prophet, right?
Yeah, but hang on. We'll get there.
Okay.
You did not sacrifice lambs for sin.
Okay.
You did not sacrifice anything with your sins on it. The sins were laid on a goat, and that goat was sent out into the wilderness. Not even a lamb involved. The other lamb was then slain to purify the place with its blood. but the sins themselves were placed on another goat, not a lamb, that wasn't even sacrificed.
So you're saying you think he got the history of that wrong?
So I'm saying that he made a statement from a I know what I'm talking about idea that was completely wrong. So, yeah, that was fun.
So why didn't Abraham just put his sins on Isaac and send him out in the woods?
Because that whole scene wasn't about sin.
He was supposed to sacrifice him.
Yeah, but it wasn't a sin sacrifice.
Oh, okay. So there were some sacrifices they did that weren't about sins, but they sacrificed animals anyway?
Right. Yeah.
And they were about what?
I mean, there were, you know, the thank offerings. There was Passover, which wasn't about sin at all. There's lots of different sacrifices in the Old Testament.
Seems barbaric.
They all involved food. I mean, that's what you do, right? You sacrifice to a god and you share your meal with him. Except in the case of our God, he sacrifices and shares his meal with us.
Well, and then the meat went to the priest, right?
Went to the priest and to the people. Only a portion of it was burned on the altar. The rest fed everybody.
Okay.
But yes. So that was a fun diversion while I was listening to him. I was like, that's not right. No. But you mentioned something about him being a prophet, you mentioned self-righteousness, etc. It's hard, again, right? I think I've said it plenty of times, right? It's hard to dig into everything that he taught. But he clearly compared himself to Christ, going so far at one point as to proclaim that he was the Lamb of Revelation who was opening the seals. Which, if you've read Revelation, you know that that's Jesus. That's not anybody else.
So Thibodeau, in his book, claims that he doesn't think he compared himself to Christ. He did compare himself to the Lamb, but he believed that to be separate. That was not Christ. But that he was the Lamb, and that he was a prophet, and the final prophet. Now, that's that hearing from somebody else thing. And Thibodeau himself admits he's no theologian. The major theologian, the couple of major theologians that lived there died. But Thibodeau claims that, and claims that, you know, he was a prophet who had revelations, and they would often do things to try to help that corridor between him and God, so that he could get more revelation, or he could hear more clearly from God. So they would help him out with things, or leave him alone to let him meditate, or whatever. And they often would do things that, you know, if they did something wrong, he would say that they caused him to shut off communication with God, that God wasn't talking to him then because their behavior.
Right. He kind of like Tony Alamo.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Who, very much like Tony Alamo.
Used that same idea.
Yeah, that was a core concept of what Tony Alamo did, where he would almost use the access to God as a way to control his people. Jim Jones did the same thing, even though later he basically said he didn't believe in God. He used that access to God, whether he had access or not access, as a way to control his people.
Yep. Well, Koresh, in one of the three or four sermons that I watched, you know, he talked about how Christ came teaching the truth, and how, you know, he was loving people and doing all of these good things, just like I'm doing. And the political arm of the day, you know, opposed him, and I'm being opposed, and we're being opposed, right? It was a very meshed, right? All these things happen to Jesus, and they're all happening to me too. Kind of sticking them together without, again, without coming out and blatantly saying, I am Jesus, right? Although, he went to Israel a couple of times early on.
Very significantly so.
Yes. And in one case, he returned proclaiming that the same spirit which landed on Jesus at his baptism had descended upon him while he was there.
Which would be the spirit that landed upon Jesus after he was baptized by John the Baptist.
Right.
That was not the Sea of Galilee. I always want to say that, but where was that at?
There, it's the River Jordan. The
River Jordan.
Yep. So Koresh is kind of teaching a kind of a Christ spirit Christology.
Even if he didn't say, I am Christ, he obviously, and this goes back into the teachings that we grew up with, this is apostasy, this is blasphemy,
blasphemy,
to come in and put anything in front of Christ. And he obviously put himself in front of Christ. To the theology we grew up in, and are still in, even if it changes over the years, is this is horrible. This is not something you do. You don't put yourself in front of Christ here. This is crazy.
Right. Yep. Yeah, that Christ spirit Christology, part of me wants to say this, but the other part of me says it's going to lead to a long conversation at work this week. There's an author, right, that's out there that's written a book that has this same Christ spirit ideology. He's a former Catholic priest. Maybe he's still a Catholic priest. I don't know. But he teaches this idea that the Christ spirit is free to everybody. So then kind of everybody is Christ. So it's weird. It's this weirdness, Nestorian blasphemy, heresy.
There's plenty of that to go around.
There is. Yep. He also, and this was the hard one, right? He also calls Jesus a man, right? He also, says, the man Jesus, right? Jesus the man on the cross. And yes, right, 100%, Jesus incarnated as human flesh, right? He became meat, right? God the Spirit became meat. 100%. But the way that Koresh says it, just the tone, the context that it's always in, my first thought was that he's saying Jesus is just a man, right? Who received this Christ spirit, this adoptionism kind of Christology, or even Nestorian, right? Jesus wasn't God until a certain point and then was no longer God while he was on the cross because God can't die, kind of ideology. Just the way that he spoke, right? Those were the thoughts that immediately jumped into my head, right? That there is some sort of adoptionism being taught here, even if it's just in kind of that subtle way, right? Which is fun, right? Because that's how we learn, right? We learn from these little subtle things, and we pick up on these ideas, and we run with them.
But that's hard, like you say, because we don't have enough source material from him.
Exactly.
To know exactly. Yeah. So, I tell you
I wish...
Let's take a little break here. Let's listen to our advertiser.
Okay.
And when we come back, let's see if we can delve into a little more of his theology.
Yeah, the good part.
The good part. When we return, folks.
Hey, everybody. This is James from Booze and Views. On this podcast, we like to talk about what's happening in the world around us and how we deal with it as Christians who may not fit into the typical mold of Southern evangelical churches. That doesn't mean that we hate them. It just means that there are some things that we've grown against and we feel a little bit rudderless at times. So on this talk, we go through, you know, current issues, whether it's political or theological or whatever the case may be, and just talk about how it affects us and how it affects our journey to remaining Christ lovers and trying to find any kind of church family that doesn't necessarily fully align with how we have grown in our faith journey. Again, it doesn't mean that we hate evangelicals or even evangelical churches. I go to one, but we have shifted in our thoughts. We have shifted in what we believe to be the ultimate goal of what it means to be a Christian in general. So join us to learn what one guy and his wife think about that, and hopefully you'll get something out of it. Thanks.
Welcome back, Matt. So we're jumping right back into it. I'm glad you picked where we did for the break, because these last two notes that I have, right, are really where he's got the most published information. And I think a lot of that, yes, comes from some of the SDA influences on the extreme emphasis on revelation and prophecy, but a lot of it comes from his own teaching that he might be the Christ, at least the Lamb, right, in Revelation. So he had a super, super heavy emphasis on Revelation. Every sermon that I found, he was preaching from Revelation.
Oh, yeah, that was his big thing. Did you examine any of his song lyrics?
No, because I didn't even think about the songs.
Okay.
Should have, because that's a big teaching tool.
He's seen the songs as an evangelistic thing, is how that's how he's going to reach out to people. And again, using the Thibodeau as a reference, because he wrote the book and helped with the movie and the miniseries that was done about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said that was kind of a drawing for him. He wanted to be part of the music, not necessarily in the beginning to spread the message, but he was told that's what it was about. But then he felt like that David had kind of gotten away from that. And after a while, he was just kind of existing. He wasn't even playing his drums, and he weren't really doing the music for a little while. Then at other times, they were heavy into it, and they got a whole music production company, and they're, you know, really working on the music and getting the music out. And it was harder back then, because nowadays you just make some music and throw it up on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And hope people listen to it and try to promote it from there. But back then, you had to get a whole process, and they were really working on that. But I just wondered if you'd seen some of them lyrics there, because I know he was trying to use that as his stuff, and I don't know how much theology came out in that.
Right. You know, because that's one of those things. I didn't even think about the fact that he was doing music and that would be connected to his teaching and his theology, though I know, like, deep within me that's a big way that teaching spreads is through the music. It just never clicked to even start digging that way, right? I spent more time focusing in on his revelation teachings.
And some of his actual sermons.
Right. Yeah. And so one of the things that I noticed in his sermons that he did, which part of me likes, right? He expected everybody in the audience to respond to a cue, right? So he would talk about, say, you know, a prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 9, right? He would give a verse, and he would expect the people to be able to quote it with him.
Oh, God is good.
All the time.
And all the time?
God is good.
You're a reluctant participant, but you know the cue. Don't act like you don't know the cue.
Well, I do, but it's not ingrained into me anymore.
Oh, it's still in me, man. And I will tell you, having gotten up and given sermons, and I know you've done the same, it's actually kind of good. It almost helps you preach when people kind of help you preach, right? and go along. So right. I see that as a technique of preaching. I'll tell you, lately I've been exposed to some more liturgical type services where they do call and response. That's a very ancient traditional way of doing services, right?
How our service was this morning.
Exactly.
There's a lot of Lord have mercies in there.
I knew that as saying that.
And that's the one I respond to.
that's the service I attended this morning was like that as well. And so that's a valid method of preaching, right? Mm-hmm. And his people listen to him preach a lot. He spent a lot of time with his people, the same people a lot. He did not do a lot of evangelistic preaching to new people.
Right. Well, it's one thing, right, to have a call and response, you know, let us pray, Lord have mercy. God is good all the time, right? Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan, right? Whatever, you know, call and response that you may have. But his was far deeper than simple call and response.
Oh, yeah?
It was full passage quoting, right? It wasn't just, you've got to remember the last line of the specific passage that I'm reading. You give me the whole thing.
Well, he did call his people to be to study those things.
Very, very deep. Yep. Yeah, but very deep on the prophecy side, right? He didn't call them up on verses that weren't prophetic in nature, right? It was always some sort of prophetic verse.
Well, and that's right? kind of the whole thing of his teaching, right? He was very deep about some things, and people were really obsessed with that while skipping over the whole rest of the Bible. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of stuff that, and granted, we do have a limited thing of what he preached on, but based on the people that have talked about what he's preached on and stuff as well, he was pretty single-minded in most of his preaching. It was the same sort of subject over and over and over again. He's a one-trick pony.
Yep. Which is crazy, because if you look at the liturgies of the church, right, throughout history, Revelation is never included. Revelation is not read liturgically in the church. And yet that's all that he focused on.
Well, I think that you...
Which is pretty cool.
Often don't see Revelation preached. You'll see some people preach Revelation. You'll see a lot of disagreements because it is a book full of imagery.
Exactly.
It is not a...
Yep.
I don't want to say that.
It took a lot to get it canonized.
Yeah. Right?
There was a lot of debate to even get it included in the canon.
I don't want to say it's not literal.
Because of the fact it wasn't read liturgically.
But it's not easy to understand. And there's lots of room for misinterpretation and for interpretations in different ways. And there's a lot to know about it. So I think a lot of people are afraid to preach out of Revelation. Then you have some people who are seemingly unafraid, and they really should be because they don't understand enough. That's the young preacher's dilemma I've seen so many times. We talked about that in the brief seminary I went to, especially about Revelation, was you get this confidence that the Spirit's going to lead me and I can do this. Well, yes, the Spirit will lead you. The Spirit led you to seminary to learn some stuff, too. This doesn't mean you can just fall into everything and know nothing.
Right.
And Revelation's a thing where many young preachers have messed themselves up. Many old preachers have messed themselves up by bowling into Revelation. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it is canonized, and all scripture is good for preaching and teaching and et cetera, as I badly quote that verse. And we shouldn't shy away from it, but we should be so careful. And this is an example of why we should be so careful.
The very first thing that he does, right, with Revelation that's wrong. I say wrong. It's hard to say that something is wrong when you're talking about biblical Greek, right? Because there are multiple ways to read something in the Greek. The history of the church, though, says that his idea is wrong. He teaches that Revelation is of Jesus, right? Verse 1, very beginning of verse 1, is the revelation of Jesus Christ as given to the Apostle John, right? Give or take, you know, whatever words exactly used. But the very first words are the revelation of Jesus Christ. He takes, in English, it's of, right? In Greek, there is no word of, right? It's just a different declension on the noun, right? In this case, Jesus, Yesu. In this case, it's Yesu. Which he reads that as a subjective genitive, right? A genitive being kind of our idea of a possessive noun. Subjective being, this was given to Jesus to give to people, right? Jesus is the one giving the revelation. Whereas the church fathers, the history of the church, read it as an objective genitive, right? This is the revelation of Jesus, right? This revelation reveals the fullness of Christ's kingship, the fullness of his Godhead, right? It's revealing Jesus to the people rather than Jesus revealing something to the people. Does that make sense?
Long way to get there, but yes.
Okay, so Koresh reads it as Jesus giving something to the people, right? And that right there completely changes the way that you read the entire book. If you read it as Jesus is giving me something to learn, something deep, something hidden, something occult, to use the Latin term, right? Then this is something for me to dig through and find it. Whereas the church fathers see it as, this book reveals Christ the King. We don't know how some of this stuff fits. We understand that, which is why we don't include it in the liturgy. But Jesus Christ is King. And so you get this weirdness with the seven seals. Do you have anything to say before we jump into the seven seals?
No. Not really.
Okay. So his way of teaching was very much like Hagee, LaHaye, even Harold Camping, right?
Harold Camping.
That's right. Very much prophecy, punditcy. We're pushing this out there. We're telling people, we're scaring people. But his seven seals is where his primary focus was. It's what his book was going to be about. It's what most of his sermons were about. And he...
So tell us overall what the seven seals is.
The seven seals are the seals on a scroll or a book that are given to the Lamb in Revelation. There are seven seals that result in seven different cosmological actions. Oh, my monitor is off. Why is my monitor off? Cool. Now I can't see my stuff.
Hashtag real challenge now. No notes.
Whoa. What happened to your audio?
Oh, that was me changing my voice to my radio voice.
Okay.
I was like, yeah, hashtag yeah, real notes now.
Definitely real notes now. But so the seven seals, you know, you have the white horse. The one who rides it's given a bow and sent out to conquer and to conquer, as a conqueror to conquer. You've got the red horse in war. You've got the pale horse in death. You've got the other horse, black horse, which is the market, famine, etc. You've got the martyrs. You've got the silence, the song in heaven. And one more that's not coming to me off the top of my head. So, but each of these seals, right, is a revelation of Christ, right, in some way or another, right? But Koresh almost picked a different name, and I shouldn't pick that name. Koresh taught that Psalm 44/45, depending on your numbering, if you're using the Septuagint, was the key to understanding these seven seals. And I really wish that my Bible was opening here. Oh well. And so this psalm, right, is the key. And if you read through the psalm, right, you see all of these pieces, right, of the psalm, right, which is talking about Christ and how it reveals the answers to the things in the seals, which is about Christ, but Koresh makes it all about himself and about the teachings that he's providing.
Because he thinks he's been revealed this, that the Lord revealed to him that he was the Lamb. And this came a little bit over time. This didn't come all at once, right? And he thinks that this has been revealed to him by the Lord. At least that's what he's teaching other people.
Right. Your mic is still set to your radio voice.
Oh, maybe I'm just talking a little closer.
I don't know. It's just weird. Yes, so the Lamb, right, which was slain before the foundation of the world, according to Revelation, is the one that opens the scroll, right? And to Koresh, that means that the Lamb is the one who makes clear what the seals mean, not the actual spiritual opening of the book. And so he refers back to himself as the one who's making it clear what all of these seals mean.
So by giving himself that power, he allows himself to be able to manipulate and change things a little bit so he can say things outside of what's actually written in the Word.
Exactly.
It's funny how other cult leaders have done the same exact thing in different ways, where they slowly basically give themselves more and more power in this as they bring themselves into the story they've been talking about. Then they can change the story because, of course, revelation from God only comes through them. And they are more and more important to the whole thing until all of a sudden they're almost God.
Right. Yeah. And one of the first things that he does is declare that Christ is the rider on this first white horse.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, Christ is the first rider on the white horse given the bow to go out and to conquer, to make war against his enemies.
Okay.
As referenced in Psalm 44:45.
I've actually heard this theory before. I don't think this is something he with himself. I think he borrowed that probably.
See, I have always been taught, right, that the first rider is the Antichrist, not Christ. So I've never heard that this was
Christ. I've heard this about Christ being the first one, kind of leading the charge and everything of the seven horsemen and all that. I don't know that that's the truth. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I've heard this.
Right.
This described like this.
Interesting. Yeah. So he uses Psalm 44:45, verse 5. Right, and stretch your bow and grant prosperity and reign because of truth, gentleness, and righteousness. And your right hand shall guide you wondrously. Your arrows are sharp, O mighty one. The people shall fall under you in the heart of the king's enemies. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Your royal scepter is a scepter of uprightness, etc., etc. But he draws on the fact that this white horseman has a bow, right? And in Psalm 44:45, Christ has a bow, right? So he's making that connection. He's saying these are the same thing. Simply by sticking them together. We threw in some information on my other website, downtimetheology.com. And there's some information here about the bow that I want to get into on that website. So make sure you check it out in the near future.
Downtowntheology.com.
Yeah. So we're gonna check that out. just to throw in a little something to make you think, Matt, since we're talking about the bow, in Genesis chapter 9, right, if you remember Genesis chapter 9, it's the end of the flood. The word toxon, right, which is Greek, so it's from the Septuagint, so it's the translated version of the ancient Hebrew, Aramaic, into Greek at the time of Christ's incarnation. The word toxon doesn't mean rainbow. Just for those of you that want to go and dig into that, go take a look.
And if you want some real fun, go to YouTube and search for double rainbow.
Double rainbow.
Oh dear. So we're just chugging right along here. So the other piece that he taught here, right, is if you disregard the teaching just on the first seal, right, not even on all of them, right, if you say this teaching on the first seal is wrong, then your salvation is in jeopardy. Anything?
Well,
nothing.
That's not surprising because they were so rule-based. They were not saved by faith through grace, at least any man should boast. They were very much rule-based. It's, you know, saved by faith, but you got to follow all these rules. Like some other groups we've talked about and we'll talk about. That gives the cult leader more power whenever they can enforce strict rules on everybody, especially if they're the one who interprets what said rules are. So that doesn't surprise me that would have to, you know, oh, you believe this or it affects your salvation. Well, yeah, that would be a common thing to say.
Right. Yeah. So he made his teachings on the seals dogmatic, right, which is a huge deal. But learning the meaning of all seven seals, as proclaimed by Koresh, right, is necessary to be a member of the marriage supper of the Lamb. Right? So again, salvation. He's placing his teaching as the dogmatic truth. Right? If you reject any piece that I teach, you're damned for eternity.
And his followers, as he would bring people out to Mount Carmel or other places where they would meet him, how they would introduce is like, hey, let David tell you about the seven seals. And let me tell you, he was apparently convincing because some people were just like, oh, whatever, you crazy loon. And other people were like, wow, he really knows the Bible better than anyone I've ever known. Let me follow this guy and figure out more. I want to study with him. And he kind of made it a whole non-pressure thing. Come be with us so you don't really have to do anything. Well, you're here. Why don't you help us out with some stuff? He really kind of made it a low-pressure thing, you know?
Yep. Well, a lot of that he really knows the Bible kind of idea, he did a lot of proof texting. Right, you know, we talked about that with Westboro. He did a lot of proof texting. He would pick out things and say, this proves what I'm saying.
Right.
Right, without taking everything into the context. And so, if you're one that doesn't know your Bible very well, right, to hear someone say, well, Ezekiel says this, and Isaiah says that, and Hosea says this, and
they sound knowledgeable. Psalms
teach you this, and Paul, exactly. They sound knowledgeable.
We even talked about the same thing in the Heaven's Gates, Hell's Flame play, how when you basically talk like you know what you're talking about, people believe that you do. And, you know, and so, well, that must be how it is, because they seem to be talking about spiritual things.
Yep. So, you know, we talked early about his manuscript, right, and how chapter one was the piece that had to get out before he would surrender. And so we don't have the remaining teachings. We know that he did teach on them, right? We know that there are pieces, but there's nothing directly from Koresh.
And the government killed most of the people he taught. Not all of them, but most of the people he taught, the government killed.
Yep. And so there's teachings, there's tidbits that are out there, right? People that say, well, Koresh taught this or Koresh taught that. but not being able to get it directly from him, I don't think that it's really necessary for us to dig into the rest of the seals.
Okay. Right?
They're all connected back to the first in some way or another, as far as the way that these people talk about them, or connected to the marriage supper. But it's not fleshed out. We don't have Koresh's own words. So I think we run the risk of saying that he taught something that he didn't.
So you're saying we just don't really, as you said from the very beginning of this, we just don't really know everything about their beliefs. And I think that goes back to our overall point about this, that, look, they were probably a bad group. Okay? They were obviously teaching anti-biblical things. So, yeah, that's bad. He married a 14-year-old girl. We can't say that's a good thing. He did legally marry the first one. He probably took advantage of others, and it was probably rape. And they should have went after him for that stuff. I'd love to see the man burn in hell just for that. Okay? I mean, good thing I'm not the person who cast the judgment on everybody. But if I was,
right,
that would be the state. Y'all be happy I'm not God. However, the government really never was able to prove anything and never really tried that hard. They just went in and killed him. That's the sad state of affairs.
Yep. Yeah. And so to your point earlier about how it might have even just been when you and I were talking, yeah, the government probably should have just left them alone, right? To that point, right, I don't want to say something that's not true, right? I don't want to say that he taught something that he didn't, or that he didn't teach something that he did. And so I'm limiting myself to just things that he taught in the way that he taught them.
Right. We can condemn the man for what we know. There's enough evidence there to say, right, hey, look, this guy was a cult leader.
This was a problem.
This was a problem.
Yep.
So do you think, if you're done talking about the theology part there, we have the last part that we always do on these episodes where we talk about if we think they were actually a cult leader, and then we give them an arbitrary school score because the points don't matter.
Right.
Of how many, you know, glasses of Kool-Aid they get. So what do we think? Was this guy a cult leader? You know,
I think so. Yeah. Looking at our list of theological criteria, there was definitely some misplaced authority, right? He assumed authority to the extreme. Definitely had some eschatological error, right? He was teaching things in Revelation. I don't know what you're messing with, but your mic is picking it up a lot.
Oh, sorry. I was checking my blood sugar.
A soteriological error, I can't say that they had error soteriologically, right? I know that he taught some things that Protestants disagree with, but most of the rest of the Christian world doesn't necessarily disagree with that.
But the majority of the Christian world does.
Well, technically, the majority of the Christian world is Christian or Catholic and Orthodox. So,
if you want to loop in two groups who don't agree, sure.
I mean, there's what, 1.4 billion Catholics in the world, but so there's that. So I don't think that I can necessarily say that he taught error, because we only have kind of that one, even potential misspeak, knowing the SDA teachings traditionally.
Because we know they were a branch off, that's the whole Branch Davidian thing,
right,
of the SDA, but we don't know exactly how they differed, because he didn't get a chance to document all that. He didn't really spend a lot of time working on that either, like some other leaders might have done. Mm-mm. He was really more about himself.
Yep. Modification of vocabulary, again, we don't really know. Right, how many things that they kind of twisted, but mistaught concepts they definitely hit. Right, so he hits three, maybe four, of the theological criteria of being a cult leader.
So I feel like he would have been a fun guy to hang out with until until they got weird. Which is probably how people describe me sometimes.
Me too.
Which is why we're friends.
Exactly.
But I feel like, yeah, he would have been a fun guy to hang out with. I feel like he deserves probably at least 3 out of 5 glasses of Kool-Aid. What do you think?
I was leaning more like 4.
4?
Honestly. So we could split the difference and say 3.5.
3.5 glasses of Kool-Aid. The Kool-Aid Corporation would like me to remind y'all there was Flavor Aid in the Jonestown Massacre, not Kool-Aid. But right. Kool-Aid's more in the popular vernacular. So 3.5 glasses of Kool-Aid out of 5. I think that pretty much sums up Waco and the Branch Davidians. So
I think so.
Brian, do we want to tell people what we have next? We got a little bit of news to talk about, don't we?
Yeah, I think we're going to kind of start shifting the way that we do some things, right? You know, we're a young podcast. We've only been doing this since May, right, of 2022. It feels like it's been a lot longer than that, man.
It does. That's because we've done more research in this podcast and some previous things we've done. We've done more work and research into this, so it does feel like it's been a while.
We are doing a lot of work.
And I don't know how young I could say young is. I turned 39 this year in just a couple of weeks. And sometimes I feel like that's not much, but other times I feel like I'm about ancient. I should be an adult anytime soon now, and I'm not looking forward to this adult status.
Nope. I agree.
My son thinks that I'm an adult, but he doesn't know the secret that I'm really not.
Right. I'm working on kind of revamping the website a little bit. I like it. I like the way that it is, but I found some new things that I want to try out and do. So I'm working on cleaning that up.
Well, and you got some other projects you're kind of combining on some of that too, right? You want to share any of your projects with us?
Yeah, so we're... I'm working on... Let's Talk Church. Ted and I are fixing to pick that back up.
Now, that's your podcast that you and I used to do together, but now you're doing with Ted, where you talk about stuff in the church world, right? That's the podcast Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, we chat about all sorts of different things that are affecting the church. You know, I think we talked, Ted and I talked about the abortion ruling. We've talked about bishops. We've talked about, you know, just all sorts of different things. So we're gonna pick that back up in the winter, Ted and I are. So I'm revamping that website, revamping our website. I'm going to revamp the God Speaks to You Network's website, which is the kind of the umbrella under which all of us fall, right? I've put that together as a spot to aggregate all of our blogs and all of our podcasts and everything into one spot, so it's easy to go find.
Which reminds me, I've got a website, a domain name, really, that I'm looking to sell for anybody who has a good idea for it. Mychurchsucks.org. Anybody who would find some use for that, I have mychurchsucks.org, and I'd be happy to sell it along to you for a very reasonable price.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I bet we can figure that one out. So why don't you tell people what else we're fixing to do?
So look, we've been talking about how can we get some more audience, because the truth is we've only got a few audience members who listen to us, and we'd really like to share with more people. We're working on some things. We're kind of tightening up some stuff. We've been working on some new show ideas and stuff. Y'all, I've been pretty transparent about this. Part of the reason we do this is because Brian and I used to work together every day, and then we didn't for a while, and then we started working together every day again, and then we didn't. Yeah, we got to have a reason to talk, because we're guys. We don't just get together for no reason. Plus, we both have families and careers and a lot of things going on. So having this makes us do this. This is like almost like a job for us. So it gives us an excuse to talk to each other. So on one hand, I don't really care if y'all listen or not. It gives a good opportunity for me and Brian to talk and catch up and talk about things we enjoy. Mm-hmm. So I only a little bit care if y'all listen. But on the other hand, I feel like we do have some stuff we can share with people. And I would like to increase our audience and share that. We're not trying to make a living at this. You know, the Lord's blessed us greatly in many ways. Neither one of us are rich, but we are very well blessed financially, in our family life, in our spiritual life. We are just crazy blessed. However, we would like to expand the reach of this show. So one of the things we're going to do is, against my great protest, but at my idea, I'm not being wrestled into it by Brian. I'm being wrestled into it myself, by myself, but not all by myself, because Brian's coming along. Is that we're going to, I'll get to the point here in a second and tell y'all what I'm, where I'm going and what we're going to talk about, what's next here. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff coming up, and the big thing we're going to come up here is we're going to be on YouTube. YouTube. We're, instead of just doing an audio only podcast, we actually do video of this podcast. I don't always comb my hair. We're just kind of sitting around at the house talking to each other, that sort of thing. But we do video to talk to each other because it's easier to talk back and forth, but you can see each other. We use a cool platform for that. And which I'd mention their name if they'd pay us some advertising bucks. But again, we're not in for the advertising bucks. Nobody's really an advertiser. If y'all hear advertising in the show, it's because we're advertising for our own projects. But we're going to start a YouTube channel, and we're going to start doing this on YouTube because we'd like to reach out to other people, and there's millions more people on YouTube than there is just the podcasting world. We will continue to do the podcasting as well and have an audio-only version of this. But we're going to start a YouTube channel and do Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods comes to YouTube. So y'all get ready.
That's right.
Brian, do you have any content on YouTube out right now?
No, I don't.
So
I've got a God Speaks to You YouTube channel that I was planning on sticking some stuff on, but I hadn't done it yet.
You don't have any content there? So I have a little content under the channel Reverend Matt Keithley, or maybe under Reverend Matthew Keithley. I've got a couple sermons I've done in the past. Again, disclaimer, like at the front of the show, these are not sermons at the church that I'm employed at. These are sermons at a church that I have previously served at, a couple of different churches, actually, I think. My son also has some YouTube content out there under TJ Vids. He's a minor YouTube celebrity. Few thousand hits, you know, a few thousand followers, that sort of thing. We've had some little bit of luck with that. They make the craziest videos of jumping on the trampoline and stuff. So we're going to start a new channel, Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. And y'all, listen, biggest thing I can ask for, please pray for us. Pray that we can use that to actually make an impact to people. The reason we talk about these cults, yeah, we enjoy it. It gives us a chance to catch up. But y'all, one of the things I think we bring to the whole arena of talking about cults that a lot of places don't bring is we try to bring a Christian perspective. We want to make sure we tell you about Christ as we're telling you about these cults that are kind of anti-Christ, right? It's an interesting subject, and we want to warn people from going the wrong way and point out what the wrong ways are there and help guide people into the right way. This is not a super preachy podcast. We're not here necessarily to be evangelistic, but it bleeds out of my pores, and Brian reluctantly bleeds out of his pores. He don't want me to use that term, but it's happening. By the way, as y'all might guess, we both have some different beliefs and we think we're going to convert each other. So we're always working on that. So I hope y'all join us for fun on that. Brian, you have anything you want to add about the YouTube channel? Anything you expect from it? What you think might happen?
No, I think it will be a lot of fun. You know, if things, you know, start to pick up that direction, we'll spin up a Discord server. Who knows? We might even spin up one sooner than that. Start doing a lot more to build the community around Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Right, give y'all a chance to interact with us and throw out some suggestions. I mean, we've got a long list of cults and groups that we want to talk about, but you know, there's one that I learned about just this week. Right, they're definitely on our list. Right, as soon as I learned about them, they landed on the list. Like. Not next, but the very next one.
Well, we're in the Bible Belt.
They're up there.
We're right here. We're in the DFW Metroplex. We've mentioned that before. There's a lot of cults around here and around this area. We're from Arkansas and East Texas, and there's a lot of cults based from there. So there's a lot of stuff around us. You know, I'd love to see having some friends on this show eventually, you know, as we talk about stuff.
Yeah.
Getting some input, even if it's some video questions, and then we try to answer some things. I think there's a lot of potential here. So, y'all, please pray for us as we launch this new venture into YouTube. We're not going out to become YouTube stars and this sort of thing, but I do hope that we can make an impression and we can be of help to people. We want to entertain, obviously, but we also want to make a spiritual difference in some people's lives.
Awesome. That sounds like a good time, Matt. Let's put our heads together and make it all happen between now and... We're going to skip the beginning of January, right? Because, obviously, I mean, we record, like, the last week of the month, which falls right there with that Christmas, New Year's...
Well, somebody important has a birthday.
We're not going to be able to do anything. Yes, absolutely. Super important.
I was talking about me, not Jesus. I mean, that guy, yeah, but, you know... Yeah. We can't verify that's when his birthday was. I know when I was born.
I mean, the church has pretty clear teaching that the Annunciation was March 25th, so 9 months later is December 25th. But, so there's a lot coming down the line. We're going to put stuff together, spend some time these next few weeks getting it going, and about the middle to the end of January... We're going to throw out some stuff and see where we land.
Well, until next time, we'll see you again.
See you soon. Thank you for joining us here on Faith, Frauds, and Falsehoods. Don't forget that we have our website, faithfraudsfalsehoods.com, where we post a more detailed blog with references so that you can go and take a look at all of this information for yourself. Also, remember to share this with a friend and help us get the word out there for everyone else. We'll see you in the next one.